You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jogai toku ingoa no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora. Welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 16th of March. It's Jogai here, your host. Coming up on the show today, my producer Jess catches up with Predator Free New Zealand spokesperson Jesse Morgan to learn more about their partnership with the Holiday Parks Association. We have Andrew Little back for our weekly chat. Jess also has a report on the Auckland University teacher strike for increased pay taking place today. I speak to Māori Women's Development about promoting social enterprise up north and along the east coast. And our news director, Shmina Smith, has an interview about a new Bitcoin company in New Zealand. If you have any thoughts throughout the show, please get in contact by calling 309 3879 or text in on 5395. Hundreds of holiday parks.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Hundreds of holiday parks in some of New Zealand's most beautiful locations may soon be free of rats, stoats and possums after the organisation that represents them signed up to Predator Free New Zealand. The Holiday Parks Association of New Zealand signed an agreement with the Predator Free New Zealand Trust yesterday, which will see its 300 member parks trapping in and around grounds. Producer Jess Smith caught up with Predator Free New Zealand spokesperson Jesse Morgan to find out more about the new partnership and began by asking about the main risks and issues with predators in holiday parks.
What are the main issues currently with predators in holiday parks?
So there are no main issues, I don't think, what they have decided to do is to take an industry-leading stance and show people that Predators Free New Zealand's really important vision for New Zealand and for our tourism. And so with how many visitor nights they get, both international and domestic, the Holiday Parks Association thought they were in a good position to lead the way, really, and really raise awareness about this goal for New Zealand and the benefit that it could bring.
Yeah. So the Holiday Parks Association of New Zealand has signed up to be in a partnership with Predator Free New Zealand. What will this partnership involve?
So we'll be working with holiday parks around the country to start trapping on their premises if they aren't already, but also they want to be show community leadership for predator control. So they will be being an education source for people, sharing information about how you trap, the benefits of trapping, and we'll help them on that way, on that journey, really, because we've got the expertise and the contacts into that trapping world, and some of these holiday parks haven't done that themselves yet, so we'll be sharing some information with them to practice and how they can run activities, get the public involved, and raise the knowledge of predator trapping in New Zealand.
Yeah, and do you feel that having holiday parks on board is a major step towards becoming a predator-free country by 2050?
Yeah, we think it's a really important partnership, mainly because it's our first one in the tourism industry for the trust. Air New Zealand, obviously, really important. We've got a really good relationship with DOC. They do a lot of really important work there for the Great Walks. For the holiday parks, we feel like it's a really good contact point to start spreading the word about this vision. And part of the Predator Free 2050 vision is getting New Zealanders to buy in and make them aware of the benefits of what a predator free country would be, because we need everyone to be involved in it.
Yeah. And how will holiday parks benefit from being predator-free in regards to both the visitors to the parks and the environment?
Yeah, so I think the main thing is that they are shown to be doing a good thing for the country and giving back. Lots of these holiday parks are in really idyllic locations with close to biodiversity hotspots, so it's places where some of our rarest species live. And so if they're trapping on there, properties as well as the trapping that already occurs in the nearby reserves, then we'll be giving those endangered species a much better chance of survival, and the likelihood of predators coming from, you know, from holiday parks or from other places into the reserve will be minimised. So our vision as a trust is actually to get a trap in every fifth backyard in New Zealand, which would mean that not only are our backyards free of rats and stoats and other predators, but it means that the trapping that happens in the reserves around cities and around settlements is much more effective for our endangered species, because we've got another line of defence before they get into the reserves.
Mm-hmm. And what are the next big steps that Predator-Free New Zealand wants to reach to achieve the goal of a Predator-Free New Zealand by 2020?
Yeah, so one of those is getting a trap in every fifth backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So part of that will be getting good traps that people are happy to use in their back gardens, and we've got a bit of a suite of tools, but there's definitely room in that suite of tools for more innovation. So we really, you know, want some of the young, bright minds coming through to be thinking of that, and so they take on the challenge of how we can create good tools to make New Zealand predator-free. There's a lot of work going into the science and technology side. Part of it also is, as I said, the social side, so getting people winning over the hearts and minds, why it's important, what the major wins for New Zealand out of this would be, and they kind of are health benefits, because these predators spread diseases and are actually quite gross.
Mm-hmm.
And then the biodiversity benefits to our species. You know, most of our tourists come here to see our nature and see the amazing place that New Zealand is. So we need to protect that to ensure that tourists still want to come to New Zealand and want to come and see our clean green spaces. But they don't want silent ones. They want ones that are filled with birds.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Those are all the questions I have today. Anything else you want to add on that?
No, the only other thing, actually, the only other benefit, or there's lots of benefits, but one of the other benefits is actually we could charge a price premium on our products. So once, you know, we've got this clean green image, and we already are selling our products, our meat and things, when we export at a premium price. But I think increasing that clean green image and will drive that price premium even higher, so it's good for our primary producers.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool, thank you so much for that.
No worries.
If you wanted to have a listen, that will be on air.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Cool, so now we have Andrew Little back for our weekly chat. Hey Andrew, how's it going?
Hi, good, yeah, how you doing?
I'm pretty good, thanks. So Prime Minister Bill English has said tax cuts are on the table for this upcoming election, and you've ruled out an increase to tax income tax. Sorry, why is that?
Because everything that we've promised so far, we can fund out of existing tax revenue, and the way the government books are going at the moment, they are looking at bigger surpluses. So we're confident we can meet every obligation we need to do the things like investing in housing, in education, in health, stuff that's going to make a difference to people, as well as starting the process of putting money into the New Zealand Super Fund and repaying government debt. So we're not planning any changes to the taxes, apart from things we've talked about, like, you know, the property speculators looking at the negative gearing rules and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the wider tax issues, wider tax system, we'll do a review of the entire tax system to make sure that we've got a good, you know, genuinely fair, progressive tax system.
Mm-hmm. And Bill English noted helping and supporting low-income families as a contributing factor for cutting taxes, but you've made the case that, you know, hey, this actually isn't the time to be spending billions and billions of dollars on tax cuts that tend to favour the wealthy.
Yeah, but big tax cuts typically only ever favour the wealthy. They don't spend their money.
Mm-hmm.
I think what the government might be doing is looking at the, you know, some working for families changes. You know, look, no one's ever going to quibble about that and say that's not a good thing, but the reality is we have a major problem with wages, levels of wages, and it's no longer just for the bottom 10 or 20% of income earners. It's actually, you know, the 60% of wage and salary earners
right.
either, you know, struggle to get a pay increase, or what they get is no longer enough to keep up with the real cost of living. When you look at what's happened to housing costs last year, actually, on average, households went backwards last year, largely because of living costs as well as inflation. So, you know, tax cuts doesn't fix that. It doesn't, you know, so we've just got to get real about some of these things.
Mm-hmm. And Finance Minister Stephen Joyce has kind of questioned your priorities and saying it's not sort of a question of whether to put up taxes or not now. We should instead be looking at how to remove the burden on hardworking families. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, they're 9 years in government. They haven't done a great deal to relieve the burden on hardworking families. And that burden right now is the extraordinary cost of housing. Now, rents have gone up phenomenally. You know, just servicing a mortgage because of the incredible increase in property costs. So if they want to talk about relieving the burden, there's a heap of stuff that needs to be done that they're not doing, haven't done in 9 years. They haven't done anything meaningful to lift incomes from that, for that kind of 50 to 60% of wage and salary earners. So they're weeping crocodile tears, and actually what it comes down to is it's classic election year bribe stuff. Give everybody a tax cut and hope they don't notice the really bad stuff that's going on.
In the last election, Labor said it would fund your pledges with a capital gains tax and by raising the age of superannuation. Why did you kind of backtrack on these?
When I campaigned for the Labor Party, I said I don't agree with those things. And if I became the leader, I would seek to change those things. Well, I've changed them. The reason is that a capital gains tax is, first of all, it doesn't stop property price bubbles. There's other things you need to do that, and that's why, you know, we're going after the negative gearing rules. And secondly, in terms of adding extra revenue to the government, it takes a long time, it takes several years before you get meaningful additional revenue in government. So, and I think we've got to look at a range of other things, you know, before we do that. And the other thing is that I want us to look at the entire tax system and issues of fairness in the whole of our tax system, not just kind of looking at bits of it. So, you know, we've got to look at personal income tax, business tax, look at whether we, and consumption tax, look at whether we need to look at something like an asset tax or capital gains or anything like that. Let's look at the whole lot on the round, and let's make sure that we can say, after we've done that, yep, we have a genuinely progressive tax system that means the government gets the revenue that it needs, that the signals are being sent for the right investment to go into the right places, and that people are being treated fairly. And I think you've got to look at everything rather than just the elements of the tax system.
Right, but issues such as public health and education are kind of in the forefront for this year's election. So how do you plan on actually delivering on these promises without raising revenue?
As I said before, all the pledges we've made, we can do in existing tax revenue. So, for example, our 3 years free post-school education training, that's based on the fact that, and you know, when the government does its budget, it also budgets at a high level for the following 4 years, and there's unallocated funds for future spending. We can use some of that. In terms of our commitment about restoring the health cuts, we're not doing that in a single year. We're going to do that over several years. But the way the tax revenue is going at the moment, we can, you know, we can meet that commitment. We can start to put money back into health, especially in mental health, where there's a crisis there now. And we can resume the contributions to New Zealand Super, and we can start the process of repaying debt. So, the tax revenue that's available now, we can meet those sorts of commitments. Before we do anything else on tax, I want to be sure that we are, you know, we're not creating anomalies or distortions in the rest of our tax system by just doing, you know, piecemeal approaches to bits of tax law.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, we heard from James Shaw from the Greens, and from what I understand, they're going to go in with a campaign for capital gains tax. You're divided on this particular issue. So what sort of happens if you are so fortunate as to establish a Labor Greens government this year? What happens to capital gains tax, and how much influence will the Greens actually have?
I guess these are the things that if we get the privilege of forming government, I mean, some of these things we'll deal with in terms of a coalition agreement. Mm-hmm. And I think the Greens understand what we want to do in terms of a review of the entire tax system, and everything's on the table there. So I'm confident that with the state of our relationship, the quality of it, the commitment that we both have, not only to get into government, but to have a progressive policy program in front of us, that I'm sure we can get through that sort of issue and you know, still deliver a strong, stable government.
So you're not actually ruling out implementing capital gains tax?
It needs to be considered as part of the working group that we will set up to have a look at the entire tax system against that principal offence. So, everything is on the table for that. Let's hear all the ideas. Let's consider everything. Mm-hmm. The conclusion of that exercise has to be we want a tax system that we know is going to treat people fairly, is going to be progressive, is going to raise the revenue the government needs to do its job, and that we can all kind of sign off on. So that exercise is the time to consider things like capital gains.
Right. And moving on, the current abortion laws in New Zealand state that it is legal to have an abortion if two certifying doctors agree that continuing the pregnancy would result in serious danger to a woman's mental or physical health. Bill English, when asked about this, sort of dismissed the issue and implied he wasn't interested in doing anything about it, and saying it's a law that stood the test of time. What do you make of his comments?
Yeah, I think that's wrong. I think it's a law that's 40 years old. I know has been a difficult issue. I think time has moved on. I think, public attitudes have changed. But in any event, we've got to know that women can make the decision about their bodies and their health. That doesn't require, certifying consultants and all the rest of it. Our commitment is to take the recommendation of the Abortion Advisory Council, and that is review the legislation. It needs to be modernised. Needs to be something that's relevant to the 21st century, and I'm quite happy to see that happen.
Right, so it is currently listed under the Crimes Act of 1961. Under a Labor government, would it be reformed?
Yeah, we will conduct that review of the Contraception, Sterilisation and Abortion Act, and with a view to modernising it, and certainly that taking it out of the Crimes Act, it has no place there. It's a health issue, and it's a women's health issue,
right?
And it's about women being able to make the decision about their bodies.
Is this issue a priority for you, though?
I can't say it's going to be. I'm not going to say we're going to do it in the first 100 days. May not be even in the first 6 months. But I am, acutely aware that it's a piece of legislation that's been around for over 40 years. It's well overdue for a review, and we'll get that underway, as soon as we can.
Right. And I know Jacinda Ardern spoke quite passionately about this, saying, it's not in my hands, why should I impose that view on others and remove their choice? Speaking of Jacinda, Nikki Kaye sort of launched a verbal attack on her in Parliament yesterday. Can you explain a bit what happened there?
Well, all I can say is what you said, is that Nikki Kaye, when she got up in the debate in Parliament yesterday, decided to launch a very personal attack on Jacinda, and Maggie Barry followed suit. I don't know what their go is. I don't know why they felt the need to do that. It's not the type of politics that Jacinda indulges in. And when she campaigned opposite Nikki Kaye in the Auckland Central seat in the 2011 and 2014 general elections, it didn't get at all personal. I think it was quite a respectful campaign. So if Nikki Kaye's been put up to it as part of a wider National Party strategy to go after Jacinda, I think it reflects very poorly on Nikki Kaye.
And I think Nikki Kaye did say that in her 8 years in Central Auckland, she struggled to name any substantial thing Jacinda's done. And I think she also criticised Jacinda's public image and saying she'll do a whole lot of photo ops and her face will be plastered across billboards, but she's failed her generation on her first day on the job. What do you make of that?
Oh, I think it's nasty, nasty stuff. Jacinda's been an outstanding advocate for children, for child well-being. She's been the driver of our policy on children's policy, on lifting child well-being for kids in poverty. That's what she does. That's who she is. And she, far from letting down a generation, she's at the forefront of the argument about making sure that the opportunities that our parents had, that are there for future generations, to own your own home, get an education that's going to set you up and equip you with the skills of the future. That's what Jacinda believes in. She champions those causes. I don't know what on earth Nikki Kaye thought she was saying or what she was doing. It's actually not the Nikki Kaye that most of us know. There are national MPs and national ministers who do command respect on our side of the house.
Yeah, I've never seen Nikki Kaye opt for a personal attack in this matter
before. Yeah, and Nikki Kerr is one of the ones who does. We have a bit of respect for Nikki. She does a good job of what she does. It just seems to come out of the blue. I hope we don't see a repeat of it.
Right.
I hope, she was put up to it by others, and that they've seen that actually this is not the way we want to run politics in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. Right, I think that's all we have time for today. I'll catch you same time next week.
Look forward to it.
Okay, cheers, Andrew.
All right, mate. Yeah, not bad. Hey, come check out some of these beautiful tracks. I've got 96kb MP3s. I've got the sick WMA from Zippy Share, some great YouTube grips, some ultra-weird Nigerian boogie. Check this. Have a slippy.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No, you're the boss. Hey, how about this? Come on and wind me up.
The Swap Meet. 4 till 7 every Sunday afternoon on BFM. It's a digger's selection of funk, soul, boogie, jazz, and whatever else is in the bag that week. With your hosts, Jupt, Kirk, Ira, and guests.
Lay back, take it easy.
I saw this girl in a black Mercedes.
The Swap Meet, Sundays from 4 p.m. on 95 BFM. It's music.
Yeah. 95.
Gun in the holster bit, right in the upholstery, somewhere right close to me.
The original originator, 95 BFM. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95bfm.com.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You're tuned into 95 BFM. About 1,000 University of Auckland staff are going on strike today after failing to reach a pay rise agreement with their employer. The Tertiary Education Union says all staff at the university should be given a fair and equitable increase in pay, but a satisfactory agreement with university management had not been reached following 7 months of negotiations. Yesterday, BFM reporter Ambrose Omega caught up with Antonia Verstappen from the TEU about what the strike entails.
The TEU's claim is really about fair pay. So at the moment, there's quite a lot of inequality in the pay scales at the University of Auckland between our most well-paid and our lowest-paid staff. So particularly, our lowest-paid staff are sort of our professional staff. Women are really overrepresented in that category. So our fair pay claim is really about kind of bridging some of that gap. And so to sort of do this, what we're proposing is having a flat rate increase rather than a percentage. So that means that all of our staff would get the exact same pay increase of $1,200 rather than, percentage being where those who are getting higher salaries receive a lot more than the lowest paid.
Yeah. Okay, just to actually build on that. So you want to do a flat rate. From what I read, you want to do a percentage, 1.2% first year and then flat rate second. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is. That's currently our claim. So yeah. Initially, we were hoping to negotiate a flat rate increase for 2017. So just bearing in mind that we've been in negotiations with the university since the 9th of June last year. So we have been trying to secure a flat rate increase for staff for this year. When the university sort of came out and said that they were going to go with the percentage increase for non-union members, we did amend our claim to try and get some traction and are claiming for the 1.2% this year, which is what non-union staff members have already received from the 1st of February, and then for 2018, from the 1st of February, going for the 1,200 flat rate.
Yeah, so I get what you're saying with, you want to do a flat rate so that the pay gap doesn't just stay the same, basically, just with higher numbers for everyone. But won't just adding $1,200 onto everyone else's pay do a similar thing? Won't it just increase the pay, like the pay gap will remain the same?
Well, no, because essentially what a flat rate pay increase does is it means that those who are earning lower salaries mean that they get a much higher percentage increase. than those who are earning, you know, the top salaries at the university. So what that means is that we can slowly start to really reduce that gap in salaries. I mean, yes, there's still quite a big difference there, but it's just a measure for us to start going about reducing those big differences. And our members have expressed to us that that's a really big priority for them and something that they're really prepared to do. And even our members who earn the highest salaries have said that, you know, they're willing to forego a bigger salary increase so that their colleagues who are earning lower salaries can get more.
AUSA is supporting strike. They've come out and done that press release.
They are.
And that's you know, that's really great. It's cool to have unity between staff and students, especially on an issue like this. But I was wondering, how do you guys plan to kind of negate the negative effects this could have on the learning of some students? Because you obviously, some tutors will have to be missed for this.
Yeah, great question. So this is really a last resort for us, having strike action taking place during class time. As I mentioned before, we've actually been in negotiations since June of 2016. So it's been, you know, about 9 months now that we've been trying to negotiate this collective agreement with the university. And we've done everything that we can to this point to, you know, really stop any strike action that we take from affecting our students, because, you know, all we really want to do is get on with teaching our students and doing our research, and we really don't want to impact our students. You know, that's a really important thing for our members. So, you know, our previous strike action has actually been focused on not having that. So we did strikes that were, you know, we had a 1 hour strike last year that was outside of lecture time so that no lectures needed to be cancelled. And our other strike actions have been around just working to the number of hours that we contracted for. Again, would have minimal impact on students. So we've sort of taken this strike action reluctantly because we don't seem to be making any progress with the university. And it's really unfortunate that we do need to take this, but at this point, we don't really have any other option to try and progress our claims without taking some kind of strike action that does unfortunately impact on students. But it is really nice to have students supporting us, and having that support is really meaningful to our members.
Strike began today at 10 a.m. and will finish at 2 p.m. as staff and students march up and down Simon Street from the Auckland University Library to Kay Road. At 11:30 a.m. this morning, producer Jess Smith spoke to Emily, a student from Auckland University, to get an update on how the strike is going.
There's about 200 or 300 people.
Awesome. And how much student support is there along with them?
Yeah, there's like about 40 or 50 students.
Oh, cool, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So what's currently happening? I've heard you guys are marching through to K Road, is that right?
Yeah, so the march went up to kind of by the new medical, the new science building.
Oh, yeah.
To the intersection at the top of Wells, the top of Wakefield Street.
Oh, yeah. And where did you guys start from?
So it left from outside the library and went up to the intersection by Wakefield Street. Then the intersection was held for a little while, and now the march is heading back down outside the library.
Oh yeah, cool. And do you know if the Vice-Chancellor has in any way addressed the strike so far?
Not that I know of, but they do love not to, so it's very likely that he's going to pretend nothing's happening.
Yeah. And what advice do you have for the Vice-Chancellor?
Yeah, I mean, he's a class enemy and he maintains the exploitation of workers at the university. Not only high-paid academics, but cleaners, administration staff. He loads, you know, impossible workloads on everybody here who are the university. We are the university, not management like STU. And the longer that this kind of class antagonism goes on for, the more brutal the resolution of that contradiction is going to have to be. The best thing that Stuart can do is to immediately concede to the TU's demands.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
The Māori Women's Development has partnered up with Akina to promote Māori social enterprise up north and along the east coast in Te Tai Tokoro and Te Ra Whiti. I caught up with the former project manager, Kay Marie Dunn, to learn a little more, starting off by asking for some context as to how this partnership actually came about.
Both of our organisations signed a memorandum of agreement in 2016, because we saw some real synergies in what it is that Akina do They are specialists and experts in social enterprise. Mm-hmm. And we thought, hey, look, this will be a great opportunity to learn from them and be able to create a bridge between their information and knowledge into Māori communities. Our primary purpose, Māori Women's Development Inc., is the provision of affordable capital for Māori women and their whānau. So we provide low interest loans, $30,000 to $50,000, to support Māori women to expand or set up their business. And what we've found in particular when we're going out into communities is that Māori women are saying, hey look, I want to get into business, but actually I want to get into business for social good. So I'm not just in there just to make money. Some are, and that's all good. But there's a real strong undercurrent at the moment of organisations and entrepreneurs that wanting to do environmental and social good as well. Mm-hmm. So I said, hey, how can we synergise and create a platform of opportunity and learning so that our people can benefit from us as partners?
Mm, right. And what exactly does the term social enterprise mean, and how do you plan on promoting it?
It's a really good question. I mean, at the core, social enterprise is exactly that. It is an enterprise that needs to be able to sustain itself financially, so it has to make a profit. But instead of the profit going back into director's fees or just to build the business on its own, that money needs to be reinvested in a way that creates real social and environmental impact or social good. Mm. So it's a bit different. And alongside that difference are a range of different tools, ways of thinking, the way that you manage an organisation, and the way that you might consider how impactful your outcomes are, or how impactful your products and services are, which is just beyond just delivering a product, like an end product, like a cup of coffee or a cafeteria, or just generic business. It requires a heck of a lot of further and deep consideration on how we can make that work so that it's regenerative to the planet, not just extractive.
Right. And how do you think this will sort of reap tangible benefits for Māori communities, as you mentioned, particularly women and maybe those from low socioeconomic backgrounds?
I think first and foremost, we acknowledge that there's a heck of a lot of wisdom that exists already within communities. So it's an opportunity, first and foremost, to say, actually, what is it that you already know? And I think it's important that we actually go in with humility to ask those key questions, because these communities, these regions, have been trading for a couple of hundred years, to be honest, not just nationally, but internationally. So what were they working with resource-wise, management-wise, leadership-wise, in the times of our ancestors? Since then, of course, we've had a range of challenges to face, but today we've still got a great network of support potential. And what we hope to do is, first and foremost, is really bring in the art of collaboration. You know, there's a desire to collaborate, but there's an art form to it as well. So if we can help communities, one, remember and also identify what they already know, the strength that already comes from within Māori communities, that's a great benefit for us. Secondly, our role would then be, how do we leverage our knowledge, our systems, our tools, to add further value to that community? And then thirdly, how might we be able to accelerate potential within those communities as well, whether or not it's support with structures in regards to the way that their organisation is built, if it's about technology that could help them do things more efficiently, if it's about creating space for people to really talk about what really matters to them, and stepping outside of the competition space, but actually moving into real collaboration. And fourthly, helping organisations think, we have a role as kaitiaki, as guardians, but how do we use that understanding and apply that to a business model that is going to really make transformative difference?
Mm.
Create jobs, yes, But there's a heck of a lot of learning and development that we have to bring into play here as well.
Right. And I'm speaking of utilising those tools and those values. I was reading the press release and you mentioned the idea of taking a kaupapa Māori approach to this endeavour. So what kind of does this entail?
So again, there's a lot of wisdom that's within our communities already, and a couple of ideas, and these are just ideas because again, it's got to land with the community themselves, is the Te Aho Matua approach, which is a framework that's utilised in Māori medium education, in particular Kura Kaupapa or Māori secondary schools, and actually right across, which breaks down to a range of understandings that we have. So for example, what is the role of our ancestors, and what is it that we can learn from them, and how do we bring that perspective into an enterprise? What is the mana and tapu that is associated with the individuals that are participating in this program, and also what does that mean when actually delivering whatever it is that the venture is in the community? Does it enhance mana? Does it detract? What does that look like? How do we bring in the spiritual components of them as entrepreneurs? So how do you keep yourself well, but also does your product and service enhance wellness in the community as well, and then also how do we bring in the unique skills and attributes that come within that group? So we're not about imposing anything, we're just saying, hey look, how do we bring out and draw out all of these different elements from a Māori worldview, and really drawing on our landscape, our relationships, our whanaungatanga that we already have. How do we bring that to bear to really make these enterprises work effectively, really, really well?
Mm. Right. And I think you did mention that there'd be workshops that you're holding up north and along the East Coast. Is that right?
That's correct. So we've got a range of kind of introduction to social enterprise from a kaupapa Māori perspective, and what does that mean? We'll be looking at what are some of these Māori principles and how would you bring that into your venture. But also we're looking at examples of traditional trade that happen within those regions. So we're again just identifying that at one point there were many successful Māori businesses and Māori enterprises. What do they look like? What did they do? What can we learn? And then also there are a range of successful Māori social entrepreneurs and social enterprise today. Mm. What does that look like, and how do we derive inspiration and aspiration from that too?
Right.
And I think, so if anybody's keen to participate, just keep an eye on our website. So for Ākina, it's www.ākina.org. And for Māori Women's Development Inc, it's www.mwdi.co.nz. We've also got Facebook pages as well. And on there, once we've confirmed the venues, we will put out our workshop list so that people can come and attend, and also a little bit more information about the accelerator program, where we will be doing quite intensive wraparound support around five ventures that we hope with support will become a significant employer within the region. But again, we've got to work at the pace and where these ventures are at, so we're just going to try our best to support them, to accelerate them to where they want to go.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
That was Kay Marie Dunn speaking to me about promoting social enterprise for Māori up north and along the East Coast.
Here at 95BFM, we've seen enough students to know that it's not soy lattes, smashed avo on toast, or chia seed detox porridge that makes your world go round. It's noodles!
Noodles!
So we're throwing a year's supply of delicious Indomie noodles to one lucky little winner. You'll have 365 days in noodle heaven, piled on toast, in a wrap, omelette, soup or stir fry. 3 minutes from hungry to happy every single day. Stay tuned to BFM to get in the draw to win a year's supply of Indomie noodles.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
You're tuned into 95BFM. Now, most of us have probably heard of Bitcoin, but we might not all specifically know what it is or how it actually works. A new local company called Bitcoin Saver aims to change that by providing Kiwis with a platform through which they can easily buy and save their own Bitcoin. Our news director, Shemena Smith, caught up with the company's co-founder, Sam Blackmore, yesterday to chat about what Bitcoin is and the ins and outs of how it actually works.
It's probably easier to understand if we sort of look back very briefly at the sort of history of currency. There's sort of been really three phases to the history of currency. There's sort of been commodity-based currencies, which are sort of gold and silver, and that's where we sort of exchanged real stuff, which everybody understood. Then the phase we're at the moment is fiat-based currency. So that's sort of politically controlled currencies. So there's sort of a central authority that sort of determines the value of the currency by either adjusting the interest rates or, you know, printing more money. And then Bitcoin is a mathematical currency. So the value of the currency is locked into an algorithm, which means that there's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoins that are ever going to be distributed, and everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
It's going back to sort of being mathematical currency. The idea is that it's globally distributed, so it's geopolitically independent. So there's no central authority which controls it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the real, really interesting part of it, is that when you buy Bitcoin, you're buying a global currency.
Mm, right, okay. And whereas with the fiat currency, that's all controlled by sort of central banks in various countries, right?
That's right, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so this kind of overcomes any barriers that might be existent with that?
Yes, it completely overcomes anybody else controlling your money. So there's no banks involved at all. There's no sort of, it seems to be insulated from particular events. So for example, Brexit and Trump, if you if you were to hedge some of your savings into Bitcoin, then you wouldn't be exposed to something happening, particularly in your country. So we're pretty lucky in New Zealand because we have a pretty stable economy, but there are lots of parts of the world that aren't as lucky as us, and it's particularly relevant to those people.
Absolutely. And so kind of on that note, what are some of the other advantages of using Bitcoin over regular currency?
So the other advantages of using Bitcoin is that it's very easy to send overseas. Literally, you can send it like an email. Someone can have a Bitcoin address, which is, doesn't quite look like an email address, but it works in exactly the same way. So you can have a wallet on your phone or your computer, which you store your Bitcoin, and then you can have a friend or family overseas, and literally you put your address into your wallet, which is pretty much like an old-fashioned email client, and ping, you can send them Bitcoin, it'll arrive like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you haven't gone through any payment network, so you haven't had to sort of give any of your money to the bank to, perform this transaction for you. So yeah, it's pretty exciting in that respect. Then the other side of things is that sort of going back to the fact that you're sort of controlling your own money. So there's a certain responsibility to it. So, if you, there's a password associated with your wallet, and if you lose that password, unfortunately, your Bitcoins are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So
roll up like you can do at the bank and be like, I left my wallet at home, I'll show you some
right.
ID.
I lost my FPOS card. No, unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. So yeah, I suppose there's that sort of trade-off with increased liberty, increased responsibility.
Right.
So that's kind of what you have to understand. But at the same time, it is a revolutionary technology in that it's very liberating in that respect, that people can take control of this stuff for themselves without sort of hoarding gold under your bed or anything like that.
And so what's the kind of current situation with Bitcoin in the world at the moment? Do a pretty small fraction of people use it, or like what's the situation?
Well, Bitcoin, it's a bit of a rollercoaster ride in the fact that the sort of governments are finding it very difficult to understand how to regulate it or how it's going to sort of affect their economies. But yeah, it's just growing very rapidly at the moment. It's growing exponentially. So the number of wallets that are being opened is growing exponentially every year, doubling every year. The market cap presently is, like, these are big numbers and they kind of don't really mean much, but it's $20 billion or $20 billion of people invested into Bitcoin. So It's very exciting. It's growing very quickly. You know, in the States these days, you could go out for your daily Saturday and you'd be able to buy, you know, your coffee and, you know, maybe your lunch and sort of generally half the sort of things that you usually spend your money on with Bitcoin. So, you know, it's becoming a lot more usable in that respect. But so yeah, it's a very exciting time for Bitcoin. We, on the service that we run, My Bitcoin Saver, we have literally grown by 1,000% in the last four months.
Wow.
The amount of people that have been using our service. So it sort of shows the interest that people have in it out there.
Absolutely. Mm. So in terms of what your service does, can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so the idea with our service is that we want to help people get ahead with their savings. And we understand it's very difficult for people these days, and that sort of housing prices are just crazy, you know. Then if you put your money into a savings account with the interest rates that are you've got at the moment, you're not going to make very much money at all using those traditional techniques. And then there's sort of funds and KiwiSaver, but they're kind of all a bit hocus pocus and, you know, quite complicated. So, you know, we believe in Bitcoin, and that's what we were drawn to. Now, historically, it's returned amazingly, so 150% year to date. So if you were to put in, bought $10 worth of Bitcoin and saved it, it would be worth $25 12 months later.
Wow.
So what we it was a service that we created actually for ourselves because we wanted to buy small amounts regularly, you know, just sort of saving the background of life like any other sort of savings scheme. And we just built a bit of software that automates the process for us. And then we put it online and lots of people started using it. So the idea is that we allow people to put small amounts in weekly. They just set up an automatic payment with us and then they forget about it, and we just send them Bitcoin automatically every week without them having to do anything, because it's quite a complicated process buying Bitcoin. You have to sort of send your money overseas to sort of crazy exchanges in Eastern European countries, and then
so
you have to use,
do all of that.
We do all of that.
And so what can people actually buy with Bitcoin?
You can buy pretty much anything on the internet if you look for it.
Right.
So there is, I think it's purse.io, which is sort of a Bitcoin accepting interface for Amazon. So you can pretty much buy anything on Amazon with Bitcoin and get a discount for using Bitcoin. So if you've got Amazon at your disposal, you can pretty much buy anything. But yeah, there's lots of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of different ways of seeing Bitcoin. You know, you can see it as a currency, or you can sort of see it as a savings platform, and that's what we tend to use it for mostly.
From what I understand, Bitcoin is a volatile currency, as there's a limited amount of coins and the demand for them changes every day. So should your customers be worried about this?
I think that's a sort of perceived perception based upon sort of, you know, history of Bitcoin. So you only hear about it when there's sort of a lot of drama, you know, that's the sort of the hype of the media. And in 2013, there was this incident around an exchange called Mt. Gox. And that was early in Bitcoin's history, when 80% of all Bitcoins globally were traded on one single exchange. So the exchange was unfortunately run by a bit of a crook, and the exchange collapsed, which caused a huge news story and hugely affected the price of Bitcoin, because there wasn't the exchanges, there wasn't the sort of infrastructure that allowed the liquidity in the market. So when that single exchange went down, the price of Bitcoin plummeted. But since then, you know, in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, there's many more exchanges that are out there. The ecosystem which supports Bitcoin is a lot more robust. So the price of Bitcoin is actually pretty stable, and it's generally been consistently going up for the last sort of 2 years.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that was The Wire. That is the end of our show for another week. Thanks to those who spoke with us for today's show: Jesse Morgan, Andrew Little, Antonia Verstappen, Kay Marie Dunn, Auckland University student Emily, and Sam Blackmore. A big thanks to my producer, Jess Smith, BFM reporter Ambrose Omega, and to our news director, Shemana Smith, for always helping me out. And of course, thank you to all you listeners for tuning into The Wire this week. We'll be back again same time next Thursday. Sigrid is up next with the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.